Welcome to Red Meat, the conservative news update you need from Odyssey stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in. A major story this week was the fact the national debt has doubled in a year, and the payments on it actually cost more than we spend in Medicaid. Sobering. But growth is a great way out of debt. So where are we on America's manufacturing front? Here's the Mark Cox Show.
Paying tremendous tariffs into Canada, and those tariffs are going to be totally eviscerated, down to zero.
Is the U.S. going to lower tariffs on Canadian autos or
luxury? We're doing certain things. We've got to give something, and we're doing certain things. They were paying a high number. We're reducing it a little bit. It's good for everybody. But our farmers are going to be thrilled. Our manufacturers are going to be thrilled. And basically, we have no tariffs going into Canada. Canada was charging us tremendous tariffs. We no longer have any tariffs.
President is celebrating a little bit of a victory lap. We've got former Senator Jim Talent on with us, senior fellow at the Ronald Reagan Institute. And Jim, great to have you back. What is your take on the tariff battle with Canada that the president appears to have won here?
It's part of a much larger pattern, Mark, that is reviving American manufacturing and I believe has put us on the cusp of a manufacturing-led economic boom. I mean, investment in manufacturing is way up. Consumer spending is way up. Productivity is up. Real income for families is up. And this is a combination of a effective trade policy, making the tax cuts certain so we have predictability, the deregulations in the president's policies, and maybe especially the energy production. I mean, we're turning into an energy powerhouse. So I'm looking forward to something similar. And I remember this, Mark, you know, 81 and 82 under Reagan, he was instituting his policies. And the economy wasn't bad, but it wasn't great. And then in 83, it took off. And I'm encouraging people to be optimistic because I think we've got good times ahead.
I do, too. Jim, tell me what I'm missing here. I grew up. I was a child of the Reagan Revolution. I know that he wasn't huge on tariffs and things like that. But then I've seen unfair trade that the U.S. has put up with for 40 plus years with some of these countries, Canada included. And Donald Trump comes along and says, we're going to even the playing field, and everybody screams bloody murder about it. Why was it our policy as a nation to let ourselves be taken advantage of by so many countries for so long?
Mark, I used to complain about the same thing. It was like, because people would come to see me and I would say, well, yeah, you know, I'm very much for free trade, but why is it that the Europeans charge a big tariff on our cars and we got virtually none on theirs? In other words, why can't we have a good deal once in a while? I completely agree with you. And I think the president's awakened everybody to it. There's a lot of people who oppose it just because it's Trump. And then there are people, I think, on the momentum of the past, which, by the way, isn't anywhere near what people think it is. You mentioned Reagan. Well, Reagan was very upset about the Japanese penetrating our car market. And he didn't impose tariffs. You know what he did? He had a quota.
Yeah.
He said, look, there's only a certain number of Japanese cars can come into this country. And you know what the Japanese did? That's when they started building car manufacturing plants in the United States, which is why we have all these plants today. So this is not unprecedented at all. And I think it's, again, one of basically four big things that the administration and the Congress has done in the last 2 years that I think is going to produce an enduring prosperity.
I want to get your take on this whole Iran situation, because Trump is now warning of economic D-Day, and it feels like Trump has threatened these things and then he doesn't really end up taking action. Now, I know he doesn't want to be too quick to actually do those things because that can have consequences, but it's starting to make me feel like, are we really doing enough? Like Mark said earlier, he said, heck, if they do a drone attack with the Strait of Hormuz, why don't we go bomb a bridge or bomb a power plant? And you do that enough times and they will finally realize, all right, we need to stop doing this.
Well, that's what he is doing when they attack American forces. And you notice they haven't done that now for about 2 weeks. They also haven't attacked the Israelis because they know it's going to come. I think it's because what we're pursuing is a policy of blockading the strait. In other words, we can we can move product through the strait. You've probably seen Chris Wright, the energy secretary, said a few days ago, he said, we're moving 9 million barrels of oil a day.
Right.
Which, when you add it to the increased pipeline production and flow, is restoring the volume that we had before the war. So we're the ones controlling the straits. And what it is, Kim, is we're throttling the economy. And the president is choosing to do it that way, I think, rather than an attack which might cause them to then turn around and attack the vital infrastructure of the Gulf states. I think that's the key. So once, think of it this way, Kim, if we go ahead and attack all of their energy infrastructure, then we don't have that as a deterrent anymore. Once you use it, right, it's not a deterrent. So they'll, and the president doesn't want the war escalated right now. He's choosing instead to blockade them economically, which is having a tremendous effect. I think we've talked about it on the show before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're just digging the hole in deeper, and, you know, eventually they're going to have to start thinking about how to get out of it. But in the meantime, okay, the key is to continue stabilizing oil prices, which have been hovering in the 80s. We'd like to get it down, and they will get down. But for now, this is the policy.
Yeah, and you and I have talked about how it's reforming the way oil moves around the world. And I just read the other day, so there's several pipelines being worked on. And two, three, four, five years from now, people aren't going to recognize the way oil moves today.
Yeah, that's why in candor, this is really stupid on the part of the Iranians. I think it was a desperation play. You're right. I mean, the Saudis are expanding their east-west pipeline. The UAE is expanding its north-south pipeline, and consumers around the world, which is to say these Asian countries, India, et cetera, are reorganizing their supply chains. You know who they're buying from now. I mean, they're going to buy from the United States going forward because those supply chains are secure. So this is a wasting asset for the Iranians. And while that happens, we're continuing to strangle the economy. The assets of their national oil company were frozen a few days ago because of debt. And you're going to see this all over their economy.
I saw it.
Now let's look at other economic indicators with Annie Fry.
Any matchups against these radical leftists, we have the resources. This is going to be the first cycle in the history of the party where the Republicans outspend the Democrats. And then we're going to do things like the midterm convention, which, by the way, is open to the general public for the first time ever. Go to GOPconvention.com and get your tickets. But then you could join us and we're going to be able to share all these great messaging things that the president has done for his first 2 years and basically explain to the American people the contrast that you have in November. Common sense versus absolute craziness on the left. People don't want that. We're going to barnstorm the country, the president. There's nobody better at delivering these low propensity voters than the president of the United States. He's the best showman that's ever lived, and we're going to ride him to victory.
So that's the RNC chair talking about to come here as we creep towards the midterm election. It's going to come fast and furious, of course. Brian Kilmeade joins us once again, co-anchor of Fox and Friends. Of course, the Brian Kilmeade Show that airs right into our show here. Brian, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Of course. Midterms, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of talk out there. Of course, we're seeing polls that suggest the Republicans need to brace themselves. But then we're seeing polls be enormously off when these primary elections end up having. Are you feeling good about the GOP going into the midterm election here?
You know what? I think it's like talking about what kind of season the Rams or Packers are going to have before the season. That's how early I think it is. Until after Memorial Day. Until after I find out what's going on with this war. You know, are we going to win it? Are we going to stay in hyperspace? Are we going to leave the gas prices up? Or are we going to do something to bring them down? You know, so until I see some of that, I really don't know. You know, it's still too early. We have our candidates, but if you can get gas and oil heading in the right direction, that means food's heading in the right direction. That means why would you change horses when the other side's only thing they have is socialism and I hate Trump? Literally, that's all they have right now.
Right. We're speaking with Brian Kilmeade, who's going to be here in St. Louis, November 21st at the Factory. Always an incredible time. We'll talk about that here in a second. I am curious as your thoughts, your assessment of President Trump, his commitment to the goal. He repeatedly states the goal, no nuclear weapons for Iran, not now, not ever. You think he's still, you know, sticking to it, staying focused and getting the job done the right way?
Yeah, I mean, we have a military plan to amp it up where they can't keep up. The question is, do you want to do it before or after the election? Every day that goes by, we get more and more weapons upgrades, so I feel good about that. But I also feel there's a lot to be played here. Let's see if something's going to happen internally, maybe give it another week. But my sense is if Iran can play a bigger role, if they amp our attacks and, you know, and cause casualties at one of our bases right in October, they know it's going to destroy the Republicans' chances of holding a substantial advantage in either chamber. And it's going to maybe plummet Trump's numbers for good, like Biden's were destroyed for good with Afghanistan. They never bounced back. So they understand our election cycle. That's why I really encourage the president to do what's inevitable, and that is amp it up even before Labor Day and finish the job. Yeah. We'll do so much damage that they fully understand that, along with the economic stranglehold, you're not going to recover. And also, why are we pretending that Russia and China aren't continuing to arm them? Why don't we tell China, you're not coming here in the fall. If I still find that you're using your ships to deliver weapons or dual-use weapons over to Iran, it's got to stop. You don't have to tell me you're doing it, but let them know. That's all in jeopardy. Is it worth it for you to lose access to our economy, to have one of these trade wars?
You know, Brian, I think that there's, for me, some, I know I love listening to you talk about specifically these conflicts overseas because you're so in tune with it. You're having all the right conversations and your intuition is always spot on in my assessment.
Speaking of spending and the economy and money, what's Gen Z up to these days? Here's Tara Servatius.
A $20 burrito, yeah, went viral a couple weeks back. Gen Z complaining they just can't afford life in America, so maybe they should try, I don't know, socialism. Well, liberal comedian Bill Maher said he'd take a look at it, see if life's harder for Gen Z. By the math, by the numbers, are they really lagging when it comes to income and affordability? Here's what he found.
This is from the Fed. Okay. 2/3 of Americans consider groceries to be unaffordable. Maybe they are. But wages rose in the last decade, including the pandemic, 46%. Food prices rose 34%. So wages outpace them by the numbers. What we spend on food. At the beginning of the last century, it was 42% of the budget.
Wow.
And then you go through the years, you know, 1965, it was down to 15%. Now it's under 10% of the butt, including eating out more. Also, Gen Z, I never realized this until people started writing about it. As they reach their late 20s now, they're getting much richer than Gen X was. Millennials and Gen Z at age 30, their net worth is around $118,000. Gen X's was $53,000, like half of that. But Gen X never complains. You gotta love those Gen Xers.
What's causing this? Could the problem here be, and the problem with Gen Z lingering at home for as long as they are, be that teenagers stopped getting jobs? Teenagers stopped getting jobs and thus have no idea the value of money. Fascinating article on this in the National Review. The author of it watched Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I actually watched that for the first time within the last year. We're going back and watching American classics. 1982 classic about a mundane absurdities of teenage life. Having been a teenager, the author writes, myself just a few years ago, what struck me immediately was that darn near everyone in the film had an after-school job. Surfer dude Jeff Spicoli was the odd man out. All the other kids had to work to finance their diets of fast food and movie tickets. Social life revolved around the mall where teens hung out because, yes, they worked there. Oh, this was absolutely how it was when I was a teenager. I couldn't wait to get a job. The second I was old enough to get a job, I got one. My parents didn't have to push me, by the way. I wanted the money. I wanted the independence. I wanted to get out of the house. I used it as a social outlet as much as anything else. Just get out of the house, have my own money, be able to, you know, have a say, everything. I loved that. I can't imagine not wanting that. But in 1982, around 55% of teenagers, 16 to 19, were in the labor force, right? It stayed that way roughly through the 90s, roughly. Went down a little bit, but for the most part. Today, only 35% of teenagers can say the same. So how are they getting by? You know, who's paying for the hamburgers and the movie tickets and the video games and the concert tickets and the designer clothes and the fancy coffee drinks that cost way too much? Parents. The hallmark of middle-class teenage life is no longer a part-time job, but a piece of plastic. Listen to this. This is crazy. 40% of American teenagers have a debit card. And here's the outrageous part. 19% have a credit card. Almost 20. As an authorized user on a parent's account? What? No, no, no. Wait. The kid doesn't have a job and you gave them a credit card? Sucker. Countless more rely on parents' debit or credit cards as unauthorized users. In other words, mom hands, hey, here's the card. Income they would have consumed themselves 40 years ago, talking about for parents, now goes to subsidize their children. They receive nothing for the money. They get sucked out of their bank accounts every month. Is this you? Why is this going on? It may be marginally harder for teens to find jobs than in the past, but most choose not to work and they don't have to. Folks, this makes sense. He writes that then when they do get a little older and they're out there actually in the world having to support themselves, one, they don't have the work history, so their wages are going to be lower to start, right? It, you know, that you haven't built it up since you were 16. And by the time I was 20, I'd had so many jobs. I'd already had offers to be a shift assistant. It wasn't a manager, but it was like a shift manager. I turned that down because I was going to college. But I mean, I already had offers to get into some kind of management, very, very low level, but some kind of management around the time I went to college, right? I couldn't do it. I was leaving town. I was like, I'm not going to be here that long. You miss that. You still started at 16. You missed 4 years of work history. And now guess what? You're 20 and you're like, well, I guess I got to get a job. Now what? You're a barista. You can't believe you've been on your mama's credit card. You have no sense of what money's worth. And then it just spirals from there. So we need to get these kids back into a job. I had fun working. Other kids would come by my job and say hey to me. Some of them trying to pressure me into selling them cigarettes and alcohol. I didn't. I took the training. I said, no, I do not want to go to prison. Thank you very much. Texter writes, you were spot on. I couldn't wait for the pocket money I could make by having after-school jobs. I learned so much from the... Yeah, me too. Cashier, receptionist, filing clerk positions. Me too. Texter writes, teenagers, they don't even want to get a driver's license. That's why I wanted my job. My parents were willing to pay for the insurance, but I had to pay for the car. And that's why I got a job. I eventually ended up driving my parents' ugly yellow wood-paneled station wagon to save money because I loved the money I had. But that got me into the workforce, and I was never able to quit after that. I have had a continuous job pretty much with like one small exceptional period, pretty much since I was 16, but really 15 and a half. Texter writes, hand them a card and the money is endless. Give them cash. Help them budget. As a minimum. As a minimum. Because I got to tell you, if they don't work, they have no idea about the value of money. Now, I'll tell you that. I've seen that with my own kids. My daughter never had a formal job, but she built a very lucrative, very busy babysitting and dog walking business where she's actually made a surprising amount of money over the last few years. And then my son, we cut a deal with him. Either you work this summer, you study for the SAT. He took the SAT deal, but he's working next summer. I started to make him this summer, and I was like, well, I'll let him study if he's going to. And I told him, you're not putting the hours in. You're going right into the workforce. So he's been studying studiously for the SAT, and I expect a good outcome this weekend. But folks, we got to get these kids in the workforce.
Gen Z. Speaking of, a 21-year-old recent college graduate was behind an anonymous website that put out widely shared fake election polling in Wisconsin, Nevada, and California. Here's Bob Rose.
Time now for the Smoking Gun. A major polling scandal rocked L.A. mayoral race after a firm admitted to fabricating poll results. This was Meridian Strategies, as they were known, creating a fake poll showing Karen Bass leading. The company claims that the move was, well, it was just a short-term social experiment to study political misinformation. A polling outfit, they admitted, surveys it released in L.A. As well as Wisconsin were fake. Well, thankfully, they are now out of business. Yeah, like I like to say, beware of social experiments.
Thank you for listening to Red Meat, a collection of conservative audio from Odyssey's talk stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in, listen wherever you get podcasts, and smash that subscribe button.